Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. 4 million Americans contracted COVID this month, bringing the death toll to from the virus to 266,000 in the United States alone and 1.45 million worldwide. Fatalities are expected to accelerate through Christmas, given so many Americans disregarded warnings against traveling during the Thanksgiving holiday. The outlook for air travel is spotty as airlines grapple with how to maintain service in a worsening pandemic, how airline hubs may be hit harder than spokes, new potential customers for Boeing 737 MAX as the jetliner is cleared by U.S. regulators to reenter service after being grounded for nearly 2 years, the British government's new Green Book and what it means for British jobs. Germany buys more NH90s and Babcock reports results. Joining us to discuss all this and more, as they do every Sunday to recap the week on world markets, are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Abalafia of the Teal Group Consultancy. Gentlemen, welcome back.
Great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Always a pleasure, Vago.
Happy after Thanksgiving, Vago.
Yes, exactly. Ron, Richard, hope you guys had a terrific Thanksgiving. So did we. Sorry we can see each other in some capacity, especially you, Richard, right up the street for your traditional day after Thanksgiving soup, which is really quite a lovely event that you host every year. This year, done socially distantly. And Sash, we wish that you could be here for Thanksgiving so that we could have shared turkey with you.
Well, thank you. Some soup.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Ron, COVID's getting worse, but the market's doing just fine. It was a short trading week, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it was, as you say, a short trading week, but not just a short trading week, but also a light trading week. So volumes were very, very low. Typically, a week like this where volumes are low, it's not honestly much of an indicator of anything. We saw follow through in the market, particularly on the commercial aerospace side. Earlier in the week, there was some strength in the names, and it kind of petered away a little bit as we got into the holiday. But broadly speaking, I think what we've seen on the street is investors participating in this kind of quote, I'll call it quote unquote, reopening trade. But lately I've been fielding more questions from investors on, okay, now what? What's next? Where does this go to from here? So, you know, I think, you know, ultimately investors will be interested in, companies will have to start delivering some form of not necessarily results, particularly in the second half of this year, fourth quarter. But as we go into next year, we're, what's the trajectory? Where are things going? So on and so forth. So, I think we're at an interesting turning point, a strong word, but maybe inflection in how people are thinking about things, but we'll see. But ultimately this week was a very, very, very light trading week.
Speaking about the lack of indicator, though, right? A couple of weeks it was vaccine news that was propelling people up. Now we have word that the AstraZeneca trials or AstraZeneca may have fouled things up rather royally in doing its rollout and its claims of a vaccine with a lot of efficacy. The toll is expected to be much worse, right? It's like really bad now, but in part because so many people traveled, it's expected to be a lot worse, if that's imaginable, by the time we get through Christmas. Is any of that like sort of registering on markets and what it means for airlines? I know, Sash, we're about to go to you, so you can talk to us a little bit about that. But, you know, any conversations you're having with folks on
that? I would say no, in that I would say the investment community is looking, as not to be callous, but looking through that. Ultimately, you know, the stocks, the market discounts in, you know, future expectations. And the future expectation is, you know, sometime next year, or you tell me when, is it mid-year, late in the year, early in the year, you'll have a reasonably distributed vaccine, which will start to turn, you know, the commercial aerospace markets. Given, you know, the tragedy that we face at the moment, I don't think the market's really contemplating that. You know, I think the market knows it's going to be a rough couple months for the airlines, clearly. But it's not looking at that. It's looking at okay, what does it look like for the airlines next year? What does it look like for the airlines the year after that?
Sash, Qantas is sort of the conscience of the airline industry, that sometimes the airline industry doesn't appreciate or is a leader in its own right. Are they on the right track in terms of saying that, hey, look, long-haul travel doesn't return to normal unless we start to do COVID tests and be more rigorous about this at the end of the day? And you would expect somebody who flies routes that are sort of in the 15-hour range to say something like that.
Of course they are. I think this is it's incredibly sensible. It's going to be very unpopular with a small but very vocal minority of people. On the other hand, it could be, you know, it could be a lot tougher, frankly. I mean, they could exist that they won't take anybody on board the aircraft unless they've had a vaccination or other the two vaccinations that are required to have a, you know, a degree of immunity. They're not saying that, although I think some countries will increasingly have that as the entry requirement rather than quarantine. But yeah, I mean, this makes a huge amount of sense. And it then becomes up to the airports and their airline customers to roll out tests that are fast enough and accurate enough that to give them all, you know, a high degree of certainty about things. But, you know, the idea that airlines are going to get, and long-haul airlines are going to get back to what we used to call normal, and we now call history, without radical changes in passenger behavior and airline behaviors is, you know, an illusion.
You know, Nick Cunningham, your colleague, has been tracking looking at Flight 24 data, TSA data. He uses a pretty, you know, good set to sort of project what where we are on commercial travel. Where are we on commercial travel as parts of Europe come out of this, but parts of the United States slide deeper into the abyss?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I wouldn't say Europe's coming out of this yet. You know, if you look at the figures last week, Europe actually deteriorated a bit. And, you know, we're down about 63% year on year in terms of aircraft movements and about 75% down in terms of revenue passenger kilometers. You know, there's a much lower seat load factor taking place. Yeah, I mean, you know, the US has been ticking up for, you know, about the last month now. And there's going to be this huge surge associated with Thanksgiving. Although it'll be very interesting to see exactly what the Thanksgiving figures are year on year. It'll then take a couple of weeks, I suspect, before we see what normal looks like. Rest of the world sort of hasn't changed a great deal. And to come back to the point that you were asking Ron about earlier on, certainly the experience here in Europe is that policy changes, whether it's a lockdown or an easing of a lockdown, take a good month to feed through to the statistics in terms of infections and so forth. Actually, they probably take 6 to 8 weeks, but politicians simply can't wait that long. So the lockdowns that are occurring in parts of the UK at the moment and are due to be lifted this week will only just start to see the number of cases going down after a month. And I think it'll then take probably another 3 to 4 weeks to work out whether you know, that was an enduring situation or not. And, you know, we've got the ability to screw everything up over Christmas in Europe, and fingers crossed. But one of the interesting things is that Angela Merkel's government is asking that European ski resorts should not open before the new year. That is causing a huge amount of angst in, you know, the big skiing nations, think Switzerland, Austria. Although, interestingly, the Italians, who I think have got a degree of angst, well, it would be angst, but it would be Italian, but let's call it guilt, because they were one of the hot spots for this in Europe. They seem to have accepted this as a policy proposal. That'll be very, very interesting to see.
The way the Italians have done this, by the way, is really, really admirable for a nation that gets a rap for you know, being unruly. It's astonishing how Italians have become sort of really disciplined about it, in part because of the sheer toll a lot paid. Richard, talk to us a little bit about the. I'm asking you this question because I know that you're a passionate lover of airline hubs. You love hubs. You've always loved hubs. I know that whenever you travel, you try to ricochet through as many hubs as you can. International Air Transport Association, led by our mutual friend Alex Dejeuniac, reports that hubs are going to get hammered worse than spokes. Walk us through what you think of that study and whether they're on the right track, and just any other thoughts you have on where we are right now and where we're going.
Well, having had the pleasure of bouncing around hubs like Charles de Gaulle with you, I know that my my disdain for hubs isn't exactly not shared by you, to put it in British speak there. Okay. Sorry, Seth.
Okay, hold on a second. As long as you're traveling with
that. I understood just what you were saying there. That was great.
Yeah. So that you do. But it's more than somewhat disingenuous to continue on the British theme. It's only good if you're traveling with a good friend and you can actually hang out in a really good lounge.
Make all time worthwhile. That's absolutely correct. But nevertheless, I think we both know that people want to go point to point. Now, having said that, IATA's study, which of course is correct, pretty much everything they say, I think, reflects reality. It didn't say that hubs were getting hit. It said smaller hubs were getting hit. In other words, people were being routed through the bigger hubs that were coming back faster, which makes perfect sense when you think about it. You got to get to that critical mass needed for proper hub functioning. So your Chicago's and Fort Worth's are going to do better than your smaller hubs, which include, like, for example, you know, Reagan National here in our hometown. That doesn't mean that we're seeing an acceleration towards point-to-point routes. Now, we are. We are seeing that acceleration, but that's independent of this study. What I think this study was trying to point out was that it's going to take longest for the smaller hubs, your Charlottes or whatever, to come back. And that's just a function of numbers. Now, having said that, the one thing I'm not really sure about IATA's numbers, they, you know, about 3 or 4 months ago, moved their recovery date to the 2019 peak back to 2024. I don't really know what's driving that. I continue to be a vaccine fundamentalist, and I think there's going to be a massive uptick in travel sometime in the back half of next year. 2022 should be just a fantastic year for travel. 2023, amazing. I don't know what's driving their 2024 expectation. I really don't. So it could be that we get back to the pleasures of, you know, traveling together through smaller hubs and bigger hubs faster than they expect.
Ron, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Richard on that. You know, we're currently looking at 2019 coming back in 2023. And depending on how the rollout of the vaccine goes, that could prove, you know, conservative, right? So, I mean, I like the terminology vaccine fundamentalist. That's ultimately, I mean, who doesn't know someone today that doesn't want to go somewhere on an airplane? I think we'd be hard pressed to find anybody. It's just a matter of, you know, how long it takes to get the vaccine rolled out and the rules and then changes on quarantining and so on and so forth. But ultimately, I do agree with Richard.
Oh, purely anecdotal. But a relative of mine coming back from Madrid yesterday, British Airways 777, so Madrid, London, that's a short route for a big airplane. And now, of course, the biggest aircraft in British Airways fleet, and it was full. I mean, you know, not a seat spare. Wow. A couple of points. There are fewer flights each day at the moment, and the tickets are stupidly cheap. This relative of mine paid £16 sterling for that flight. So, you know, wow. But it shows you price elasticity of demand works for air travel. We always knew it did, but that's how the airlines are going to get traffic back again.
Let's talk a little bit about price elasticity. 737 MAX is back after U.S. regulators cleared the aircraft to return to service in the United States. We expect European approval, EASA approval to be coming in January. And then, of course, all eyes are on how Beijing is going to treat this. You know, doubtless it will be caught up in sort of wider discussions between Beijing, or tied to wider tensions between Beijing and Washington. We had Alaska, right? Delta last week expressed interest, an airline that has a reputation for being rather ruthless with buying airplanes. We have Alaska and Ryanair, two carriers with large 737 fleets, saying that they are interested. Are these votes of confidence, opportunism? What do they mean for the program going forward? Whoever wants to grab that first.
I'll jump on. I think it's both, right? I mean, when you look at Ryanair, they tend to be ruthless is a strong word, but I mean, you know, they're a very prudent buyer, frugal buyer of aircraft.
Astute buyer.
There you go, a very astute buyer, as is Alaska, right? So as is Delta, right? So you have three very astute buyers of aircraft looking at the aircraft, which, of course, if they order planes, that's great. They probably will be my guess. And then it's, aircraft being sold is always a form of a vote of confidence. Now, the big question becomes at what price, right? Where were those aircraft priced? What does that mean for residual values? You've seen the lessor community back away from the airplane, almost, writ large, because I think there's a lot of uncertainty, where, residual values are going to go, what initial lease rates are going to be. Boeing has upwards of who knows how many whitetails that they have to reposition, and that'll have an impact on price. So it's no big surprise that three of the best airplane buyers in the industry are looking at the airplane, because ultimately for that aircraft, it's a buyer's market, not a seller's market.
From my standpoint, I think there's good news and bad news here. The MAX 8, as we've said before, is an extremely good aircraft. And, that combination combined rather with low prices means you'd be foolish not to get any whitetails or put your place in line. The problem here is that it does absolutely nothing for the top bracket of the market or the bottom. So again, you've got Boeing being marginalized. It's an MD-90 scenario where they think they were going to offer an entire product line of single aisles. They're really just offering one. It's a really good one, available at a really good price, but it's a recipe for product line marginalization.
Tash?
The question I would just ask is, how many of these are genuine new orders and how much of this is just mopping up the white tails that we know that Boeing has got? They're genuinely new. This extends the Boeing backlog. Great. But we know the Boeing backlog is now, the unbuilt backlog, because they built a ton of whitetails, is now half that of the A320neo family. Boeing's got a long way to go before the 737 becomes a serious contender again.
Sash, changing gears. Her Majesty's Treasury, just three, sorry, restating, 3-2-1. Sash, the new Green Book issued by Her Majesty's Treasury changes the government's policies. That will be very, very good for British defense workers. There's a sense that this move has been long overdue, and it may be somewhat less good for American defense workers. What did the Chancellor's team do? Because this is an extremely consequential shift.
I apologize to everybody because this is a slightly dry issue of public policy. But the Green Book is what the UK Treasury uses as the it's effectively a set of metrics to enable a department to decide and then to prove that they're getting value for money in procurement. And in our sphere, that means buying defense stuff. And historically, the UK Treasury has been incredibly dry. It has said, you've just got to buy the cheapest, best value thing. Benefit cost ratio, has got to be quantifiable. You've got to be able to say, this is why a product was cheapest. This is why this is the best value, a bit of procurement, end of. And that has tended to mean that it has been very easy for the UK Armed Services to buy products that have been developed abroad and can be bought off the shelf because they can prove numerically that this is better value than going and developing something in-country, because there's clearly more risk associated with an in-country development and sometimes an in-country procurement. The UK government has got a policy of levelling up, which means trying to put more work into the poorer areas of Britain, into the areas of Britain that have become disadvantaged, which tends to mean the north and the east of the UK. And the Green Book has changed the way that this is assessed. I think this is the most significant change in UK defence procurement policy for at least two decades, possibly three decades. I think I said earlier on in our chat in my lifetime, not quite, but pretty damn close. It certainly measured in decades. And now what it says is the way we used to look at buying stuff really favored buying off the shelf and buying from abroad where the product was developed. And it totally fails to benefit the nation as a whole and to benefit UK employment and UK technology and UK development of technology. And therefore, we, the UK, the Treasury, are going to change it. We're now going to heavily weight stuff that is bought in the UK. We are going to penalize stuff that does not create jobs, create technology, and, you know, create it in the right places. And for US companies, this is a disaster, because US companies are notoriously bad at bringing jobs to the UK when we buy stuff. So, you know, JLTV, why would the UK buy the, you know, JLTV when we literally buy the things straight from an Oshkosh production line, put some radio harnesses in, possibly a splash of paint. Jobs created, technology created, nothing. Purchase of Chinook helicopters. The work involved in the UK is infinitesimally small. It's going to put Wedgetail really back on the you know, the on the line again. And probably the most interesting thing is in missiles. The UK's got a very active missile policy anyway, team complex weapons. But there's been a lot of talk about the Royal Navy replacing both Harpoon, the anti-ship missile, and Tomahawk, the land attack missile. And the Royal Navy would clearly like to buy more of the same if they are available from Boeing and Raytheon. But I think the first evidence of the Green Book coming into effect is that the government, and no, not the MOD initially, has said we're going to join with the French in a common long-range cruise missile, which will have an anti-ship capability and a land attack capability, and is going to be submarine launched as well as ship launched. That is an astonishing change of policy. I mean, the Navy are smarting from that, because it just was not what they expected even 5 days ago. And I think this just shows that we've got a, you know, got a policy that pretty much every single one of our neighbors and allies has got, from your side of the pond through to France, Italy, Spain, Germany, Netherlands, Norway, Sweden. We've been very much the exception. Now we're actually falling into line. I really think this is going to cause the US some significant problems, because you've never had the culture of actually transferring complete product lines and technology to the UK. And if you don't do it, you're not going to sell.
And obviously UK is, you know, seen as such a savvy buyer that once the UK buys it, it makes it easier for you to sell worldwide. I should also point out that the north and the east of the country were where Boris Johnson and the Tories gained a lot of seats in the last election, getting frustrated. You know, some traditionally labor areas, Grimsby being one of them, the home of the legendary fishing fleet, that sort of swung from labor to Tory. I just want to get both Ron and Richard's sense on this, because the UK is a very, very fertile market. So it's a two-part question, right? You know, any sense on what the economic impact, Ron, would be on American companies? And Richard, you tend to always argue against national buying, in part because countries get a lot less when they do this, right? I mean, so Britain is actually, while it's giving stuff up, is actually getting kit quickly, reliably, part of broader production lines, as opposed to, not to bring Nimrod up in its various iterations, but Nimrod, small, unique boutique fleets that tend to be not as perhaps capable or broadly capable and available. So guys, take a bite at it from each end. Ron, start us off.
Yeah, when I think about, you know, the foreign military sales or direct sovereign sales to the UK, the US industry, right, kind of just kind of scratching back in my kind of memory banks. I mean, I would imagine the UK is 5% of foreign military sales for the US. So I don't know if you know that one off the top of your head. So, I mean, it's material, but it's not overwhelmingly material. And then, you know, when you look at, you know, how would this impact, you know, what's a big, you know, foreign military sale into the UK? Well, F-35 is one of them. How would this impact a program like F-35? You know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, I don't know if the market's going to immediately look at this and recognize it as a headwind, just because of the materiality of it relative to the, you know, the broader market and, you know, I guess that's the best way to say it, you know, relative to the broader market.
If I can jump in there, I mean, Ron, I think you're probably right. I suspect the UK overall is no more than 5% of UK foreign military sales, and there are clearly some huge purchases in the Middle and Far East. I think the area where it's going to be very interesting, though, is the example, or, you know, yeah, the example it sets. You know, if it says basically it is okay to do something that may look stupid, but keeps work, keeps business, keeps orders in country, and it's okay to build up your own industry, even if that has a short or medium term cost. That is going to make it hard. You remember, almost every U.S. defense company 5 years ago said, we're going to get foreign sales, international sales, up to at least 25%, sometimes, or 20%, sometimes 25% of revenues over the coming years. And they did a very, very good job of that. This just suggests to me that there's not a lot more upside to that.
But I mean, ultimately, Vago, right? I mean, this is what the U.S. does, isn't it? Right. And we've had numerous conversations over the years where the U.S. would develop a system and you and I would say, hey, why didn't they just buy X, Y, or Z that someone else developed right. that is as good or better, right? Right. I don't know. So it's...
I think this is overdue. Britain has tremendous engineers, tremendous amounts of talent, tremendous amounts of innovation. And the ecosystem has benefited from Britain maintaining that kind of capability by buying some of its sovereign capabilities. Not to sound like I'm an agent for the UK torpedo market, buying P-8 made sense in part because Britain had an urgent need. The Russians were sort of at the door. It was important to get that capability. But Britain didn't even demand integrating its own torpedoes into the ship, and therefore dealt a death blow to the world's, I would argue, among the world's, if not the world's, best light torpedo makers and torpedo industry. So it just, you know, you have to take all of these things into consideration. And I remember having these conversations in Abbey Wood, now going 25, 30 years ago, with Lord Howe, where he was under enormous pressure from the military to just buy kit and get capability and just get on with it, which was the sense. The implication of that, unfortunately, is at some point you have to do a tempest in order to rescue your combat aviation industry, something I think we've discussed on this program often. The French are a lot more strategic than Britain has been. Richard, I want to bring you in because time in part is also running a bit on the short side, but give us your sense on this, because you tend to be a free marketeer more often than not on these issues.
Well, yes, but to quote Stash and use his words against him, it's okay to do something that looks stupid, which brings us back to Nimrod. In other words, for every tempest, there's a Nimrod. And, you know, that's not to say that the idea of moving back towards national considerations and strategic autonomy is a bad idea. Far from it. I think there's a lot about Green Book and whatever else that I would welcome. For me, okay, I'm turning the focus back to U.S. politics, and I apologize for that, but to what extent is the U.K. shift, and certainly accompanied by the shift in France, Macron's, you know, grand strategic ideas for autonomy, to what extent was that driven by Trump's endless bashing of NATO and, of course, trade wars and everything that went with beating up on allies for no apparent reason that we can figure out? And if Biden comes in and extends an olive branch saying, okay, trade wars are over and Article 5, we really mean it, is that going to take some of the wind out of the sails of the strategic autonomy people who are developing these nationally based systems or regionally based systems? And indeed, it might have just nipped it in the bud, because the idea of European defense funds for national strategic systems that were regional strategic systems never really quite got off the ground. I mean, you know, there was some progress towards, well, you know, FCAS and Tempest, but really nothing like the kind of major shift that you'd expect to see over 4 years of a U.S. president implicitly abandoning NATO. So we're going to have to see how that evolves.
You know, listening very closely to what both NATO and European leaders are saying, that does not change. There is a recognition that that Europe has to do more for itself by buying more at home and fostering industries at home and fostering cooperation at home to not be dependent. So Trump succeeded in one sense better than he had hoped. I mean, although the trajectory was to increase defense spending, nations did end up spending more money. They spent more money in the short term buying some American capabilities to mollify the American president, whereas the long-term trends are actually do more at home, rely less on them. We'll see whether or not that's idle or a tectonic shift. But when the incoming chairman of the NATO Military Committee, Admiral Rob Bauer, the Dutch admiral that is going to replace Sir Stu Peach later this year, the RAF Air Chief Marshal, when he says we're going to have to do much more in Europe in order to advance European capabilities, that should be seen as a sign, right? So there won't be a complete snapback. I think that this is driving a trend, perhaps a positive trend in greater investment and greater spending, but it will be with an asterisk and a caveat over it. However good it is, for example, for F-35 in the short term, right? I mean, a number of countries decided to buy that platform.
If I can just add one last point there, I think that and you know, Rich's points are really well made. And the last 4 years, it's not been pleasant being a NATO member here in Europe. It's been very uncomfortable. But I do think that the longer term picture is that yes, it'll be much easier to work with a Biden administration. But there is a recognition that the US, or a perception, I should say, that the US is going to be much more focused on the Pacific, because that is where the biggest direct challenge to the US is. And therefore, for the Europeans, it's just not realistic to expect that we'll get back to the status quo of 10 years ago, where Europe had the majority of the US focus, military, technological, political. You know, you've got much more important things to do over in the Pacific now.
Yes, and that was also part and parcel the misreading of Europe's Obama Pacific pivot strategy, which was, you guys got this, you have capabilities, be in the lead, get your house in order, sort this out. We're chin deep in the Middle East and in Afghanistan, and we have to focus more attention on the Pacific. Why don't you guys stand up and do more? And I remember at the time, Bob Gates was Barack Obama's defense secretary, who went over there and delivered some real hardwood in his departing speech, and messages that Leon Panetta drove, Chuck Hagel drove, as did Ash Carter, of, hey, you guys really do have to step up and you have to do more for yourselves at the end of the day as well. So I think that's true. Speaking about doing more for themselves, Richard, talk to us about NH90s for the German military. Berlin has really been on a spending roll and spending at home increasingly, right? Whether in acquiring new Eurofighters, now we have a new tranche of NH90s for the German military. Talk to us about what all this means.
Well, blow me down.
You said what now?
I said blow me down. There's a surprise.
Quelle surprise. Yes, Richard, start us off with NH90, and then Sash, please feel free to weigh in on that as drolly as you'd like.
First of all, I would take gentle exception with the idea that there was any significant increase in U.S. procurement of U.S. systems by NATO allies over the past few years. I don't think it really shows up in the numbers at all. There was certainly talk of it, and we'll see if the Germans actually execute upon their plan to purchase 45 Super Hornets and Growlers. But in terms of everything else, I don't really think it shows up in the numbers. What does show up in the numbers is a renewed determination to, well, create a bridge between current generation European systems and next generation European systems. So this week we saw 31 Sea Lion versions, naval versions of the NH90 ordered by the German MOD, while simultaneously starting to discuss with other countries in NATO about a next generation mid-sized utility helicopter to follow on the NH90 sometime in the 2030s, 2040s. That's going to be really interesting to watch because, of course, you know, the NH90, like the Tiger, like the 101, all the other current generation European helicopter programs, you can see the end in on the horizon. So they need to, well, buy more, a last tranche of the existing systems to create that bridge, just like they're doing with Project Quadriga, the Eurofighter, buying another batch and perhaps another one beyond that and a similar batch in Spain, in order to create that bridge to FCAS. And there seems to be a renewed determination to actually maintain the defense industrial base in these countries. Will they actually follow through on orders? Well, so far we are seeing it. And this week's NH90 order was proof of that.
Sash?
I was very, very surprised by the decision basically the main European NATO members to launch a new helicopter program. Okay, it'll be 15 years out probably. But I think, to get the UK involved at this stage when, you know, we have only bought our biggest procurements of American helicopters, Apaches and Chinooks, and, you know, we're awash with both of them. But then to have a you know, policy that says we're going to develop a new European helicopter. I was really surprised that came out when it did. And that the UK is in at the start, along with France, along with Italy, along with Germany. Now, you know, European programs have all sorts of ups and downs. So the chance that it doesn't make it to the finish line is relatively high. But I think it's a really interesting declaration of intent. And I think also, you know, as Richard said, it's very, very interesting because what it tells us is that Europeans don't see a commercial life for NH90 and the AW101 much more than the next 10 to 15 years. And, you know, for someone who thinks of NH90 as being a very new helicopter, that was a real jaw dropper for me.
You know, if I could just quickly add to that, it's kind of interesting. Meanwhile, the UK, you know, for a half century, there's one consistent theme. They will do elaborate studies, all coming to the same conclusion. We need more Lynxes. So I wouldn't be surprised if yet again, there was another generation of Lynxes after half a century plus.
Or Wildcats. Very quickly, Sash, Babcock, what did they have to say? And give us a Brexit update. Dominic Raab, the foreign secretary, sees a quick deal if the EU caves on fish demands. That's sort of where we've been stuck, and not entirely clear the EU is going to cave on that or agree, or right, because it has been part of the impasse. Where are we more broadly on Brexit as we get to the end game here with December 31 looming?
Babcock first. Most interesting statement came from the new CEO, David Lockwood, who was previously at Cobham and did a very, very good job there. And he upfront said, we, Babcock, are the second largest UK defence company by revenues. Yeah, right. And also he said the largest by the number of programmes. Babcock's got this incredible spread of programs, some new builds, some maintenance, some overhauls, a lot of flying training, a lot of ground support training going on, but very much painting Babcock as a UK defense company first and foremost, and, you know, up there in economic value with BAE Systems. And I think Babcock feel a lot more happy about life than they did even 3 weeks ago as a result of the first results of the integrated defence review, which you'll remember has confirmed the Type 31 frigate, which Babcock has the contract for, and introduced this new frigate type, Type 32. Well, I'm betting Type 32 is one better than Type 31 and probably looks strange. It'll probably be the frigate that Type 31 should have been, i.e. a bigger gun and a lot more land attack missiles. But, you know, that would mean that Babcock had frigate production into the 2030s, and that's pretty attractive for investors. And I think after, you know, the share price was astonishingly volatile on Wednesday when they reported, but actually it's been very, very strong since. And, you know, David Lockwood is carrying out a strategic review. You'd expect any new chief executive to do that, you know, we were pretty impressed by what he had to say. And I think, you know, they've got a tailwind at the moment from the UK defence budget and the focus on naval in the UK. Brexit is coming down to the wire. It probably was always going to. Actually, it's coming down to the fish. At the moment, there is a common fisheries policy that has all of the EU in it, which means that although the UK has got a, you know, very substantial home waters, i.e. half the North Sea, half the Irish Sea, and a big chunk out into the Atlantic and so forth, the UK only gets about 10% of the fish that's caught, or UK-based boats only get 10% of the fish that are caught there, which was, you know, a trade that seemed entirely reasonable as a part of being in the UK. The current offer from the EU is that the UK boats would get 18%, and that's not going to impress the new blue wall political seats that all voted for Boris Johnson a year ago. And I suspect that if there isn't a resolution on fish, all the other good stuff about free trade is just going to fail. And I think that what's going to have to happen is this is going to have to be go away from very, very technocratic negotiations. Michel Barnier on the EU side and Lord Frost on the UK side, it's going to have to go totally political and up to Angela Merkel and President Macron, because I don't think the negotiations are going to succeed in coming up with an acceptable deal.
Ron, you get the last word. What are you looking forward to in this new week? What's the market going to be thinking when it reconvenes for what we're going to be only a few normal trading weeks before we get into Christmas and New Year's and Hanukkah?
Yeah. So, and I think importantly, we'll be back into some normal trading volume to see, you know, kind of how the market digests what happened over, you know, the last week and a half or so. So I think, you know, the early trading, call it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday this week, will be, I think, important for setting the tone into the end of the year. Another, I think, important point, particularly for the defense stocks, is ultimately who was selected to be defense secretary. I think there was some surprise that that announcement didn't happen last week, but the expectation is that it'll come out this week, maybe in the first half of the week. So I think there's some investor interest there. And I think that's really about it. There's probably some more vaccine news, you know, in the coming weeks to come. But it seems like each time a new vaccine gets announced or efficacy or whatever happens, the market's kind of desensitized to it, that the market understands that, you know, the vaccine train is on its way.
You know, to point out, right, that the Biden team is expected to make an announcement this week for a lot of other senior cabinet positions, including for defense secretary. And, you know, some folks think it'll be Michelle Flournoy. Others would say if it was Flournoy, she would have been announced, and it may be another candidate, although we're told it would be a qualified candidate. Guys, thanks very, very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure having you guys on. Look forward to having you guys on again next week. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Thanks, as always, Vago.
Always a great time, Vago. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.